welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Israeli far-right groups have marched in the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian protesters have also gathered at the venue of the so-called March of the Flags, which marks the anniversary of Israel's 1967 occupation of the city's eastern sector. Tel Aviv's annexation of East Jerusalem al-Quds during the Six-Day 1967 War has never been recognized by most of the international community. Israeli forces have cordoned off roads leading to Damascus Gate in the city and arrested a number of Palestinians on the steps of the gate leading to the old city. Now, is this supposed to end up in violence? Stay tuned to Press TV and watch us discuss aspects of the issue with our experts. Let's get an update first. Let's go to Akiva Ramallah. Mona Candela is there. Mona, over to you. What's going on there?
Well, despite the metal barriers that were erected by the Israeli police in Jerusalem, Al-Quds Old Town, and in the streets leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate, Bab al-Amud, however, Palestinians, thousands of them, succeeded to reach Bab al-Amud area, the Damascus Gate, and demonstrated their protested in order to prevent thousands of Israeli settlers who were taking part in Jerusalem flag march. Clashes erupted between the Israeli police who were protecting the settlers. According to paramedics, 33 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces. 17 others were detained by the Israeli soldiers during the clashes that erupted in the Bab al-Amud area. Palestinians sent a clear message that even the Jerusalem flag march, and despite the strict measures, and we are speaking about over 2,000 more Israeli police officers were deployed in the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to protect the settlers' march. However, Palestinians succeeded to reach there and to send a clear message that Jerusalem, Al-Quds, will always be a Palestinian, and that Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islamic, and they will continue to defend it. Israeli forces closed Arab and Palestinian shops in the old town. The streets that around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, like Al-Misrara, Bab al-Sahira, as well as Sultan streets, were completely closed by the Israeli soldiers. The route of the march changed a lot by the Israeli forces. However, the Israeli settlers did not enter the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the gate of Bab al-Amud was completely closed. The settlers didn't enter the Bab al-Amud gate in order to enter to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. However, they marched and celebrated and sang and danced in the complex of Bab al-Amud. However, Palestinians, elderly women, youths were there to confront them despite the strict measures and despite the attack by the Israeli forces who were protecting the settlers. Experts said that that was a challenge for the new Israeli coalition cabinet in case they, for the last moment, they were expecting that the Israeli cabinet would end this protest or would change completely the route of this march, especially after the warnings from the Hamas movement that sent a warning to the Israeli cabinet that if the settlers enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, they would bear the consequences.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Mona Khan and Ramallah. Now, joining me in this debate tonight will be Palestinian activist Amal Wahtan in Ramallah and also professor of media practice and philosophy with Coventry University, Kenneth Ho, in London. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Akiva Ramallah. Amal, what does this day back in 1967 remind the Palestinians about?
Yes, in 1967, of course, the Israeli occupation occupied the rest of Palestine, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And for them, in this Jerusalem Day march, they're trying to show off that they were able to unify Jerusalem under the control of the Israeli occupation. And for us Palestinians, it was a nakba at that time Nakba in 1948, and it's continued. This Nakba is continuing until now, while the Israeli occupation still seizing our land and killing our people and seizing Gaza. So the Nakba for us continues, and this march today and the show of illusional victory, let's say, that they were able to go on with their flag parade shows that they have been defeated, because Jerusalem has turned into a military barracks. 20,000 soldiers and policemen were spread in Jaffa Gate and in the streets leading to the old city of Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem has turned also into military barracks. They closed all shops, Palestinian shops, and they forced the owners to go to their homes. So the whole city was turned into curfew for the Palestinians, but it was full of soldiers. The marchers themselves, they counted for 2,000 or 3,000, but the rest of them were Israeli policemen and soldiers. So this show, of course, shows that the Israelis were defeated today as well, because the Palestinians were demonstrating in all streets leading to the old city of Jerusalem, and that's there were as well confrontations in several areas. So they think that they succeeded in this flag parade, but at the same time, the Palestinians showed their will as well.
All right, now let me ask Professor Farrow, is this the right time for the Israelis to hold such a controversial rally? It's only weeks since a truce to stop the Israeli deadly aggression on Palestinian lands.
Well, I think, as we've seen before, there's a pattern of provocation in situations like this, and that's part of the way that the Israelis have handled the situation externally. We've heard about the military suppression internally. Of course, Israel depends on its position in terms of the international reflection of the actions that it takes. And so it has considered this, and it's allowed this to go ahead. It's created the situation. We have to, of course, repeat the fact that Israel is a settler state. It's a violent occupation. And Palestinians have suffered violence since 1948, and that violence is physical, mental, cultural, and economic. And actions like today, and incidents like today, act towards a kind of humiliation, an attempt to humiliation of the Palestinians. And we know that since 1948, there has been resistance and always been a fight for the right of return. So when people take a position, when Palestinians take a position against Israeli aggressions, every time they do that, they're part of a long history of resistance to occupation. Now, there's always been a political battle for Palestine in the international world, and this is about ideas, about representation, rhetoric, and images. These are all issues. But I think what's happened recently, there's been a shift, there's been a change in favor of Palestine and the Palestinians. And I think this has happened because there was a shift around the notion of Israel as an apartheid state, which has been happening over the past 10 to 15 years. We had the boycotts of Israeli goods, and the notion that Israel and South Africa are similar entities. And this is something which has gained a kind of traction internationally. We know that in every situation, there's always a battle for the hearts and minds of people, and media is a very, very important part of that. We saw this in Vietnam, for example, where the Americans, we know, lost the war. And I think there is that kind of feeling at the moment, particularly in young people, who all of a sudden have suddenly gained an interest in Palestine. And we've seen it internationally across the world. The TikTok generation are really completely involved and interested in the situation of Palestine. And this is something which is reaching millions and millions of people. Over 300 million people on TikTok talking about Palestine, debating Palestine, and showing concern for Palestine. And I think so, whatever happens on the ground in Al-Quds or in Gaza or in the rest of the occupied territories, in Palestine as a whole, is feeding into a much bigger debate, and that debate is really quite radical compared to what we've had over recent years. Okay. Young people are saying that they don't believe in the Oslo Accord, that the Oslo Accord is dead. They're not even believing in the two-state solution. And I think this is a great shift in recent political kind of debate that we've seen, which the media is very importantly feeding into. And of course, that's why Palestinian media is being suppressed today by Israeli authorities. We know that there's been a huge clampdown because they do not want images of suppression to be beamed across the world because they know that's a losing battle.
Okay. Now, Amal, the new government in Tel Aviv has lent full back into the holding of the March of Flags in this sensitive juncture. It seems that a new prime minister doesn't care much about how the Palestinians feel about this occasion. Let's have your take.
Of course, both governments, the former and the current government, they don't care. They come actually from the same roots. They're both ultra-Zionist, ultra-racist, ultra-Nazis. So both government leaders of the former and the current governments are extremists. So they don't give or they don't care about Palestinian lives. They don't care. The only notion that they care about is the Zionist ideology, which is seizing the whole lands of the Palestinians. And that's what we are currently going through inside Jerusalem and the surrounding neighborhoods of Jerusalem, like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan neighborhoods, seizing more and more houses and ordering demolishing of houses, of more houses. 638 houses are to be demolished in Silwan. This is ethnic cleansing. So the policy of ethnic cleansing continues since 1948 up until now. Now the Palestinians own only 10% to 12% of their land, while the Israelis are seizing most of the land. It is an apartheid state, and world opinion has changed gradually until last month, when they were more convinced that this apartheid state has to be stopped, that has to be dismantled. If we want to reach peace and security and prosperity in this region and for the whole world as well, this apartheid state must be dismantled, and a new state should be, one democratic state should be established on its places where we can have a normal life in this region. This apartheid state actually poses a threat to the whole region and internationally as well. We can see that they are outreach as Africa or Eastern Europe. So the ramification of the existence of this colonial apartheid regime in this area is causing danger to the whole world.
Right.
Nonetheless, the region and Palestinians as well.
Okay. Kenneth, you know that Tel Aviv has put the air defense batteries on high alert and fearing rocket fire from the Palestinian side. Do you expect an escalation? And if that happens, how violent would it be this time around?
Well, I think the violence is there. The violence has never gone away. We can't really talk about escalation because on a daily basis, Palestinians are suffering and they're dying. And so in the way the framing of this in the media, particularly in some elements of the Western media, is as if these are just small explosions that happen and it's just a matter of getting the two sides together. That depiction is an entire lie. It's been a lie since 1948 and it's never stopped. And I think we have to get away from this notion that, you know, it's just a question of something happens and then there's a reaction and then another reaction. This has to be part of the analysis of the situation, the analysis of the creation of the state of Israel as an apartheid state, the function of its state, how it works internationally, how it relates economically to the United States. This is what we need to consider, because if we're constantly going to be dealing with day-to-day aggressions and reactions, and whether that reaction is internal to Palestine, whether that's international, we're never going to move away from a circle of discussions and discussions. And I think that the shift towards the recognition by governments now, who are beginning to listen to their people, you know, things only change when people move. That's the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen recently in this, in terms of the issue of Palestine, is that there's been a move from great sections of the international community, an interest in Palestine, and a determination to support Palestine. We also have to recognize the role of refugees, Palestinian refugees, who were forced from their land violently in 1948 onwards and had to go as refugees across the world. And they've settled in those countries. And those, the children of that generation are growing up and asking questions like, why can't I go home? They're in a position of power. They may be filmmakers, they may be models, they may be scientists. They are part of those societies, whether it's in Canada, the United States, or Europe. And now they're using their power to explain to the world that they are not satisfied with what's happened. They want the right of return. Their families want the right of return. And so the debate, I think, has to be shifted away from the violence. The violence has to stop. There should be intervention. Okay. There should be international intervention in the violence which Israel is using against the Palestinians. And this is long and long overdue. We all know that the reason this has been allowed, permitted, and actually encouraged is the United States and its need to control the Middle East for its own economic purposes. Okay. So this is the bigger picture.
Okay,
and
if you allow me, we have only 1 minute left. Let me put
the
one last question to Amal. Amal, with Naftali Bennett assuming the post of prime minister in the Tel Aviv regime, would you expect to see change in the Israeli policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians? We have only 1 minute.
No, of course not. As I said, the former and current governments are the same. They were in the same party, actually. They're part of the Likud party. So nothing is going to change for us. And the fact that four elections occurred in 2 years shows a lot, shows that this whole state is descending or is in a descending phase. The internal problems that they have, even within the right-wing Zionist parties, is incredible and is affecting the rest of their own people. So the demography is working against them. Palestinians in all of Palestine, historic Palestine, are exceeding in numbers. They're uniting together. The new generation of 1948, together with the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, are in one but fighting and resisting this okay. occupation in all means. The resistance in Gaza and the axis of resistance actually in the whole region are supporting the Palestinians. The international free people are also
okay.
on our side. So
unfortunately, I got to jump in. That's all the time we have. Sorry for
interrupting. The course of history is very.
Okay, and that's with that we should. I should appreciate the contribution made by our guests. We had Palestinian activist Amal Vahta and Ramallah, and professor of media practice and philosophy with Carnegie University, Kenneth Ferro in London, with their contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafino.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Djawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We said that we're in part two, and part two is how we, or our relationship with other people, and chapter one of part two was our relationship with our kin. Now we're entering into chapter two of part two, and that is our relationship with fellow Muslims. And fellow Muslims are divided here. Ayatollah Jawadi divides this discussion, this chapter, into three parts. The first is our ta'amul, how do we deal with fellow mu'mineen, fellow believers, the faithful, the practicing, if we could say, practicing Muslims. And number two, how do we deal with sinning Muslims? And number three, how do we deal with those who appear to be Muslims, hypocrites, for example, and whatnot. We're going to discuss the other two, but in today's discussion, what are the rights of your fellow Muslim religious practicing believers? We need to remember that, you know, you also need to be emotionally there for people. Number one, materially there. Number two, spiritually there. Morally there. Number three, moral support. Number three is emotional support. You know, why is it so recommended for us in all of these ahadith to smile, to be humorous? When you meet your fellow mu'min brother or sister, smile in their faces. Be kind, be nice, be generous. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُبْغِضُ الْمُعَبِّسِ فِي وَجْهِ أَخْوَانِهِ. Allah hates someone who frowns in the face of their fellow brothers and sisters. If someone was to make a mistake, forgive and forget. You know, you don't need to, when they do come and apologize to you, you don't need to say, well, you did this and you did that and you did this and you did, no, absolutely not. Remember it there and just forget it whenever it happens, and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive you and to forgive them. Even if they've wronged you, you also forgive them. Whether they are someone who is from your same faith, from your in the sense of your same sect, or someone else. That's why here in this hadith from Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, the Ayatollah Jawadi Amuri has selected to mention here, and there are many of them that is also mentioned, is where he says, Ya ma'asharu shi'a, O Shia, make sure you do this to your fellow Muslims, in reference to the Sunni Muslims, to the remaining Muslims who are around you. Do what it is that you need to as far as your brotherhood and sisterhood is concerned. Make sure that you participate in their salah, and you listen to their mu'adhin, and you observe the amana, and you visit their sick, udu mardahum, washhadu janaizahum, and you participate in their funeral processions, wasallu fi masajidihim, and that you pray in their masajid, wala yasbiqunakum ila alkhairi, and don't let them precede you in good. You be good, you always be good. فَأَنْتُمْ وَاللَّهِ أَحَقُّ مِنْهُمْ بِهِ. You, the followers of Ahlul Bayt, you are more entitled to be doing good. So remember that you should always be doing good, whether they are fellow Shia or whether they are from your Sunni brethren. You need to be treating them in the best way possible.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book مفاتيح الحیات, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح با دو جلد باشه. چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book, مفاتیح, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است. چه فرون دماغ و سواب داره فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
So we were talking about believers and how do we deal with fellow mu'mineen, mu'minat. We do understand that we have to try to strengthen that network of brotherhood, sisterhoods. There's so many things that we need to work on in our communities. I understand that there's also that issue of tension that might exist between the fellow believers. They're of your same rank, they're of your same party, they're of your same faith. However, you know, you might not feel comfortable with them. You might disagree with them. That's fine. That's not a problem. The problem happens when you start harboring hatred towards another fellow believer. That's when the problem happens. The Holy Quran says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَلَا تَجْعَلْ فِي قُلُوبِنَا غِلًّا لِلَّذِينَ آمَنُوا. This should be a mantra that we repeatedly recite. It should be a slogan that we have right there on our forehead all the time. And this is in the form of a dua as well. Oh Allah, do not place in our hearts any level of grudge or malice feelings towards those who believe. Yes, there might be problems. Yes, there might be a misunderstanding or issues or whatnot. But you look at the verses of the Holy Quran, look at the riwayat of Ahlul Bayt, and they all point to one thing, that even if someone has wronged you, even if someone has done dhulm to you, ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive them, to forgive yourself, and for you to never harbor that kind of hatred or negative feelings towards other people, especially those who are believers, practicing Muslims. You know, I don't really feel comfortable by saying when I say practicing Muslim, you know, because if you are a Muslim, you have to be practicing, you know. If you are outside of the boundaries of a practicing Muslim, you know, if you're someone who, as we mentioned, who does ghish and deceives and is unfaithful and unloyal and all these other negative, bad, haram things, you know, what kind of Islam are you following? Is it just by name? And so I don't feel comfortable when I say practicing Muslim, but this is, you know, a kind of commonly used word in today's society. And I think everyone knows what it is that I am referring to. Though the mu'mineen, the mu'minats, those who, you know, have embodied Islam in their practical life, you know, we need to strengthen one another and we need to be there for one another. We need to have that level of love and compassion towards one another. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The world with reporters. On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats Abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do, because there's a lot of obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of U.S. foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After more than a decade, Israel has turned the page of Benjamin Netanyahu's rule, ushering in a new era with a new coalition cabinet led by Naftali Bennett, the head of the right-wing Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, the leader of Yesh Atid party. However, the Palestinian leadership remains skeptical, saying it expects no changes in Israeli policy towards Palestinians. It says the only difference that could be seen is that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will no longer be there. Palestinian officials say they expect the Bennett-Lapid cabinet to be worse than the one it's replacing.
Israel's policies won't change even if a new coalition is taking office. There is no hope for change from the Bennett rule. In my opinion, it's more extreme than the one it's replacing. Bennett is likely to pursue the same right-wing agenda as Netanyahu. And here comes the role of the international community to prevent future aggression and violence against the Palestinians.
Bennett, a former chairman of the Yesha Settlers Council, has long vowed to prevent the establishment of an independent Palestinian state, and he supports the annexation of major parts of the occupied West Bank, as well as expanding settlement construction. Experts say Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and will continue to act this way even if he's not an opposition leader anymore, or at least supposed to be. Israel's new cabinet held a festive first meeting Sunday night following a historic Knesset vote, with 60 members voting in favor, 59 against and 1 abstaining. Bennett urged his ministers to show restraint over the numerous ideological differences between parties in alliance to ensure its stability. Bennett will serve as prime minister first as part of a rotation agreement with Lapid. He will serve alternately as prime minister and foreign minister until the handover of power to Lapid on 27th of August 2023.
Experts warn that in an attempt to prolong the life of the new fragile eight-party coalition, Naftali Bennett, the new Israeli prime minister, will exert every possible effort to appease the most extreme elements, especially through the continuation of settlement activities across the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Ngo Dinh Diem, a pro-American, became president of South Vietnam in 1955 and, with the assistance of the U.S., began to arrest anyone suspected of being a member of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition. The U.S. then gradually increased its troop deployment to the country, fearing that communism would soon spread across the region. In 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin incident gave the U.S. government an excuse to justify a war on Vietnam. An intruding U.S. destroyer clashed with North Vietnamese Navy torpedo boats in August of that year. In an ensuing sea battle, one U.S. aircraft and three North Vietnamese torpedo boats were damaged. Also, four North Vietnamese soldiers were killed. As a result, the U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. After a bloody and protracted war, a truce was struck in 1973, ending direct U.S. involvement and completing the evacuation of American forces, which had grown to 500,000. The war claimed the lives of 58,000 Americans and 4 million Vietnamese. It impacted 700,000 American veterans, cost the U.S. more than $100 billion, and tarnished the country's image and morale at home. However, the true narrative behind the Vietnam War was revealed after then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara commissioned a secret history based on classified papers, the Pentagon Papers, in 1967. He formed a research team to assemble and analyze Defense Department decision-making dating back to 1945. An analyst on the research, Daniel Ellsberg, eventually disclosed portions of the report to the New York Times, which was published in 1971. The papers revealed that the U.S. had secretly enlarged the scope of its actions in the Vietnam War, with coastal raids on North Vietnam and Marine Corps attacks, none of which were reported in the mainstream media. The Pentagon Papers are an important record of the United States' first defeat in a war. To this day, the United States' failures in the Vietnam War, as well as its atrocities in terms of civilian casualties and the deployment of chemical weapons, have stained America's reputation at home and abroad.
Ashes and rubbles. There is nothing more left as despair has once again taken over Rohingya refugees in New Delhi. A devastating fire has brought down the entire camp to ruins. Around 55 families were residing in the camp. Most of the refugees have escaped unharmed, but all they had has turned into ashes. Now some local NGOs and residents are lending support.
It was around 11:30 in the night yesterday when my children started crying due to the heat of the fire. When I opened my eyes, there was huge smoke and fire. We immediately got out of our shanty and moved to the safety.
The residents of the camp are not sure how the fire started, but an eyewitness said it started in the middle of the camp, and within an hour, everything was on ground, and it took the firefighters a lot of efforts to control it. Rights activists have urged the UN Refugee Agency for prompt response in helping them with every possible way.
I don't know why we are facing all this hardship. Our lives are miserable. We can't live in our own country with dignity. And wherever we go for refuge, hardship follows us. I'm happy to have my child alive. I can't forget the scene I saw yesterday. Even if I close my eyes, it frightens me.
The camp is surrounded by a cluster of shanties where people from all faiths live. Many people I spoke with had a suspicion that either the fire broke out due to a short circuit or it could possibly be a conspiracy to vacate them from the location, since the deportation campaign to expel Rohingya from India has gained momentum in recent years. The blaze has destroyed everything these people have had. Now they have to brave both the harsh heat of the summer and the fear of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their miseries continue to mount with each passing day. In a display of mercy and compassion, scores of neighboring residents and activists from the NGOs reached the spot to lend whatever help they could. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in India who are now stuck in limbo amid a vicious campaign to deport them. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Mohammed Al-Attar, a Palestinian teacher, has lost his wife and three children in an Israeli airstrike in his house in North Gaza Strip. Mohammed's four-story building that was a shelter for his entire family totally collapsed to the ground. Mohammed, who used to have a normal life, working at a school and looking after his kids, is now homeless and without a family.
Israeli airstrikes hit our building without any prior notice. I just opened my eyes and found all of us under the rubble. Some of us managed to get out of the rubble. I tried to save my children, but to no avail. I called for help from Civil Defense Service, but it took long till they reached us. I just want to ask the international community and human rights groups, what are our rights? I had a peaceful life and suddenly I became homeless without a family. I lost every hope I used to have.
Hassan Al-Attar, Mohammed's father-in-law, has his own sufferings to tell. Working in the civil defense services, he was surprised with a call informing that his daughter, along with her three kids, were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubble.
I was at work when Mohammed called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubble. They were in ambulances. They were all out on missions and I had to wait for one. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubble. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling. Hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory.
Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Against the racism
racist and Islamophobic far right in defense of public and individual liberties. That's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far-right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with death threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the president of the republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
For the last time, the seven presidential candidates stood toe-to-toe at the headquarters of Iran's national television, the IRIB, to face off for the third and final debate. While the debate was themed with people's concerns, it was derailed every once in a while toward other issues, such as foreign policy, a topic toward which the two camps of the principalists and the reformists have conflicting stances. The debate saw the two pro-reformist candidates, Abdel Nasser Hemati and Mohsen Mehralizadeh, stressing the need for Iran to join the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, or the FATF, a global intergovernmental organization tasked with combating money laundering and terrorism financing. Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that have not signed up for the FATF.
Mr. Jalili, only you and North Korea are saying that the FATF is useless. Are you saying the 200 countries around the world which signed the FATF do not understand that it's useful or not? The FATF is meant to contain money laundering and terrorism. Please think twice before making any comment.
Saeed Jalili, a heavyweight principalist, called Iran's entrance into the FATF an irreparable mistake that completes the puzzle of sanctions by the West and the U.S.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
But he did not elaborate on his stance during the debate. Along with other journalists, I waited outside the debate studio to investigate his take on the FATF and how he would treat the international convention should he become the next Iranian president.
The Iranian government has already signed an action plan with the FATF. Rouhani has agreed that Iran implement 39 out of the 41 articles of the FATF. Iran did comply with those 39 articles, yet that organization has approved only 16 of them. Furthermore, the FATF has made an announcement that if Iran fulfills the entire 41 articles, still it would define the next step for the country. Iranians need to know about these facts.
As part of Iran's action plan with the FATF, initially agreed upon more than 6 years ago, the country had to finalize four pieces of legislation. Two were passed by a reformist-dominated parliament. but the incumbent principalist-heavy parliament has halted the approval of the two remaining bills and referred them to the arbitration body, the Expediency Council, whose secretary is another presidential runner, Mohsen Rezaei. Rezaei says any decision regarding the FATF now is tied to whether the U.S. would lift its anti-Iran sanctions as part of the ongoing Vienna talks between Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal over the revival of the 2015 accord. This is how the upcoming presidential election could shape Iran's foreign policy. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president. While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, the debates have helped them to narrow down their choices. But the question of who will be the next Iranian president will be answered on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To mark the 2,000 days of the detention of Sheikh Zazaki, the Islamic movement in Nigeria issued a statement expressing concern over the continuous detention of the Islamic cleric, but most especially the silence of other Nigerians over this injustice. In December 2015, Sheikh Zazaki was arrested by security forces following an attack on his home and worship center, where hundreds of his supporters were killed by soldiers. The statement by the Islamic movement said the silence of those who are supposed to condemn the injustice is more painful than the jubilation of the oppressors.
The masses should know that if today is Sheikh Zazaki, tomorrow it may be you. If you are a Christian and the government is detaining the Sheikh, well, you want to kill the Sheikh because he doesn't practice the same ideology in Islam with them, what about you that you are a Christian? You should come out and join hand and fight against injustice and say no to injustice and oppression.
For over 5 years, members of the Islamic movement have been coming out to protest, seeking for the release of Sheikh Zazaki, but the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Over 300 supporters of Sheikh Zazaki were killed and dumped in a mass grave without proper identification and funeral prayers. This and the attack on Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters, according to the Islamic movement, were despicable and unacceptable.
That is the worst that has happened in the history of Africa, where a detachment of army of a country, we launch an attack to a bona fide citizen, an innocent citizen, to his house, is the worst crime against humanity in the history of Africa.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki is spending close to 6 years in detention. The Islamic movement in Nigeria called on the Nigerian authorities to comply with the Federal High Court order and release Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zainab. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, But while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, this is a show on which we've gotten the chance to celebrate the auspicious birth anniversaries of two of Islam's most prominent characters, a brother and a sister. Imam Ridha alayhi salam, our eighth infallible Imam, and his beloved and precious sister, Sayyidah Masuma Salamullah alayha. This brother and sister are perhaps the pearls of the country of Iran, and they are the most precious treasures that this soil has embraced in its heart. And Sayyidah Masuma Salamullah alayha, of course, is not a character that we'd only want to celebrate once a year. The fact that she has a glorious shrine in the city of Qom, and the fact that this desert has turned into the cradle of Islam, means that she's a personality that we celebrate 365 days a year, and alhamdulillah rabbil alameen that we have the opportunity to do so. This is one of the examples. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, Sister Razia.
MashaAllah, beautifully said, MashaAllah. Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I love the way you say things. They're beautiful.
I love that I get to discuss them with you, and I get to talk to you about this privilege that we have here in the city of Qom. Welcome to the show, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much, my dear sister. Seeing so much energy from you, I get a lot of energy. Thank you for having me.
Alhamdulillah.
And assalamu alaikum, my dear sister Zainab. And a warm salam and greetings to all our audience, wherever they are in the world, wherever they are. And of course, let's not forget a very warm salutation to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, ajalallah ta'ala farajahu sharif, who is watching over us at every moment of our life.
Of course, this is an occasion that we should verily, indeed, give our congratulations to Imam Zaman as well, because it's not every day that it's your most beloved Amma's birthday, and it's not, and definitely not all Amma, not all aunts are Sayyidah Masuma Salamullah
alayha. It's a special, unique aunt.
Exactly, very special, very unique indeed.
Right.
So, Eid Mubarak to everyone, wherever you are, like Sister Razia said, we're sure that your hearts are here, and Eid Mubarak to Al-Hujjah, Ajalallah Ta'ala Faraj al-Sharif. So, Sister Razia, we spoke about Sayyidah Masuma Salamullah alayha, brief history, her scholarly, her spiritual, her political status and understanding, of course, which is more important, and how the best testament of her nobleness and her lofty position in the eyes of Allah was the fact that she's turned this desert to a cradle of science and knowledge. And I think to myself so often that if it wasn't for the presence of the daughter of the Messenger of Allah, I don't think anyone would bother to live in this city, such a climate, such a weather, such water. But this gem, she really has turned all our hot summery days
to an
heavenly
oasis.
Spring, exactly, to an oasis. So, question. A very pressing question too. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering. Sayyidah Masuma Salamullah alayha, she, as splendid as she was, she lived a very short life.
Yes,
27. That's almost, you know, the age I am at. Almost, approximately the age I am at right now, and my life achievements are nowhere close to hers. Nowhere at all. But with so many achievements that she had, I wonder that Why didn't she ever bother to complete the other half of her religion, as our narrations tell us? Why didn't she ever get married? Yeah.
Right. Very good question. Once a man came to Imam Baqir alayhi salam and said, well, you know, I am after spirituality, I'm after self-fulfillment, self-discipline, and so I decided not to get married. And so the Imam told him that if remaining single would bring someone